Hello, everyone. Welcome to the USQ Blue Stocking Week podcast. In Blue Stocking Week, which is an initiative of the NTEU, we celebrate women's achievements in higher education and public intellectual life. Here at USQ, the NTEU have collaborated with the USQ Women's Network in order to emphasise the achievements of our female researchers here. As part of this, we're having a discussion about issues of gender within academia, and I am joined here by three wonderful guests. I'd like to introduce Dr. Jane Pershing, who is a history lecturer here and has recently authored a book, Beautiful Bolts, From Displaced Persons to New Australians. She is the founder of a Facebook group called Academic Mums and is an active advocate for academic mothers using the Twitter hashtag, #AcademicMums. We're also joined by Dr. Nikki Solway, who is a senior lecturer in creative writing at the School of Arts and Communication. She's the author of not only a range of academic works, but two novels, Repetta and Dying in the First Person. And finally, I'd like to introduce Dr. Kate Davis, who is a senior research fellow at the Digital Life Lab, and her research focuses on the way that people experience information in social media. So thank you to you all for joining me today.
Thank you, Jess.
Thank you. So one of the main questions that I'd like to start with is by looking at what it is that you think, how it is that gender has shaped your experience of academic life throughout your career.
That's such a broad question, Jess. It's really hard to address it. I think in a way, for me, I can't speak for Katie and Jane or you, it's so hard to separate my gender identity from myself. So, you know, my academic career has certainly been impacted by my gender in various ways, some of which I'm conscious of and some of which, you know, no doubt I'm not conscious of. You know, I can think of key moments in my career. I remember doing the confirmation for my PhD many, many years ago with a breastfeeding baby being held by my mother at the back of the room and having the panel be deeply disturbed by it and commented on it during the question period and in the document afterwards that they didn't feel it was appropriate for me to have a job. to job interviews where I've been asked about my caring responsibilities and my sexual identity and... Jane's making faces at me.
That sounds slightly illegal to be asking those questions.
You know, I think that all the way along it's been a positive thing in some ways in that when I've encountered positive role models, particularly other women and other queer people, and I think other people who are experiencing discrimination in the academy, so Indigenous people and other people of colour, people dealing with disabilities in the workplace, you know, are sometimes allies but sometimes kind of mirror similar structural and cultural discrimination. So sometimes positive in that those people have been great role models and great sources of information and support, but sometimes really disheartening to see that in the more than 20 years I've been in the academy, we've made huge strides, but we're still not where we might have dreamed of being 20 years ago, I think. So
I'm a fairly new academic. I have been working in academic roles for about 8 years and just got my PhD in 2015. And I think for me, being a female academic has been shaped a lot by my own personal context, which is that I'm not a mother, but I have caring responsibilities for children who are my sister's children. And I have a unique home life where we have adjoining houses. I live with my mother and the three of us kind of muck in together with the kids. And so for me, I guess I've kind of had to negotiate all the things that a mother might negotiate without having the status of a mother. And because the kids were very young when I came to academia, my whole experience of being an academic, doing a PhD, negotiating all of that has largely been shaped by my experience as a not mother but pseudo-parent. And, you know, it's been quite challenging to kind of work out where I fit within things. And so I guess that means that some of the kind of discrimination that I've faced hasn't necessarily been the kind of structural discrimination that other women who are mothers might talk about. But I've had some of the you're just the auntie. Like, why do you have to drop everything and go pick the kids up from school? Or, you know, why do you have those same kinds of responsibilities? So that, I guess, has really shaped my experience in good ways and in not so good ways as well. You know, the flexibility of being an academic is amazing for parenting, but there's other aspects that aren't so good. So for me, that has really been a kind of defining characteristic. And I guess I hadn't really thought about myself as being a feminist, or the way I relate to the world, or the way that I might be hindered by those kinds of structural, that kind of, I guess, systemic, the systemic gender disconnect, I guess, before becoming an academic. I worked in libraries, which are largely a female-dominated profession, and when I was within it, it was hard for me to see the impact that that had on the profession, and it wasn't until I stepped out and taught into that profession that I saw it. And so for me, my whole, I guess I've kind of had an awakening around this stuff since becoming an academic.
So I did found a Facebook group called Academic Mums, and I guess a lot of my thinking in this area is shaped by being a mother. That's because I accidentally became a mother in my second year of undergrad, and then in my second year of doing my PhD, and then in my second year of unemployment after the PhD, or underemployment, I should say.
So we always need to watch you in the second year of any given year.
That's exactly right. And actually, we're coming up to that time again, but it's not happening. So for me, it's always been something that has been, I guess, the most obvious thing that has shaped other people's perceptions of my work, that I've always had it with me and have been known as, you know, the mum with young children. And I've had young children now for, you know, almost 15 years. So the reason I set up the group was... I set up the group a few years ago in that just before I think I graduated with a PhD, because a lot of mothers in academia, and, you know, that also encompasses students, so whether you're an undergrad, whether you're doing honours, and then, of course, if you're doing a master's or PhD, are very isolated. So we tend to do a lot of work at home. We don't have the time to be on campus, like a lot of other students and a lot of other academics. And so it was more about providing a space to give support for other mums in academia. And, you know, I should say really that has been something, the mothering aspect of being a female in academia has been the main issue for me, the only issue, to be honest, probably until about 6 months ago, when I came up against some really overt sexist discrimination just on the basis of gender and not on the basis of caring responsibilities, which, you know, shocked me a little bit. And I think to some extent it's 2017, we think this work has been done. Okay, we think we're equal. And of course everybody knows that, and of course everybody will treat us equally. You know, that caring responsibilities, particularly being a parent, is a little road bump, you know, that we have to try a little bit harder and you know, come up with some solutions to different issues. But actually there's still gender discrimination out there.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that you've all mentioned here is this role of caring. There have been various studies that have shown that women in universities not only perform higher service roles, but also than their male colleagues, but they also carry these greater burdens of emotional labour. And it's the emotional labour of what you're doing at home, but also the emotional labour of the way that you interact with your students and with your colleagues. Is this something that you've encountered?
Absolutely, yeah. So in my previous role, I was a course coordinator, and I did have a different relationship with my students than I saw some of my male colleagues have, and I managed that course coordination role in a different way. I had a much higher pastoral care component to what I did, and I worked in a team of women as well, and so I think we all took on that kind of role. I personally think that that aspect of teaching is really important and fulfilling, and we need to recognise that our students are whole people. And often I was dealing with students who were second career. Lots of them had small kids at home and they were looking to get back into the workforce. And so we did have kind of a bit of a counselling role around helping them to feel comfortable back into study, and maybe that kind of made that pastoral care role greater. But I think it relates to students, but it also does really relate to colleagues as well. I see it all around me.
Yeah, I think it's something that's not necessarily valued as part of academia amongst academics. So the normative academic is a man who takes his research seriously and produces a lot, and is perhaps on that pedestal to above the students. Yeah, so that can be something that maybe women, you know, we're more used to having that pastoral care aspect in our life anyway. Perhaps more used to having the hard conversations with students as well that men tend to back away from, in my experience. But that's something that's not valued as far as our work goes, and the men don't have any repercussions at all from not having that aspect in their teaching, which is a shame. Mm. Yeah.
And it certainly doesn't benefit us on the promotion trajectory.
No, sure. It's not something that's measured in promotion or in your enrich processes, so your annual review processes. I was thinking too that maybe it comes from students' approaches to us. I know that when I've taught collaboratively in a course where there were male teachers and female teachers, that we used to laugh, ha-ha, but not really, about, you know, that my male colleague would get approached with questions about theory and critical reading strategies and those sorts of things, and students would come to me with their depression and their childcare issues and their, you know, so that even if we're kind of more prepared or more easily fall into those roles, I think there's also a perception that women are carers from the student body, so that they're more likely to come to us, perhaps. You know, I've never done a study on it, and I don't know of any studies on it, but it's certainly been my experience that if there are, that students are more likely to approach me as a woman.
And that takes a lot of time to sort of work around those issues. I know that I get approached for extensions over and above the amount that I imagine is covered by USQ policy, with screeds of paragraphs about why someone deserves an extension.
It would be an interesting study, actually, to look at kind of patterns of pastoral care and that relationship.
And look, I think it's important. I think it's important as well, because we do have lives, and I think particularly our students, a lot of them are mature age students. Mm. They're online students, and they do have kids, they do have jobs, they do have, you know, sick parents, and things happen. But on the other hand, there's also that perception that's our job to do that. Yeah.
Do you think that if you don't respond in a caring enough manner, that the repercussions for you are different for your male colleagues if they dismiss the extension request than if you dismiss the extension request? Are you perceived differently?
I think I was thinking about that. There's a study done recently, I wish I could remember the name of it, about teaching evaluations, and that when there was a study done where the gender of the two teaching team members were switched for some students, and that the reports that the students made of the teacher's performance across a range of kind of things. So even though the teaching staff of both genders had returned assignments on the same day, that the students said that the female teacher was slower and lazier and less competent and all these other things, even though they didn't, does that make sense? And they didn't know that they were actually assessing a man. They thought they were assessing a woman, and the study showed that their perception of the gender of the person shifted their response. So even though I don't know of any data around that, I would expect that that's true, that students do have different responses to their teaching team based on their perception of gender roles and all kinds of, you know, their unconscious biases, which we all have and struggle to overcome, I think.
Yeah. No, student evaluations are known to be gender biased. And I think that we could probably all think of instances where we've had male students who won't accede to our authority as lecturer or our, you know, professional
experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so I mean, that's actually a really hidden, a hidden thing that academic women have to cope with on a daily basis.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think I experienced as well as a young female academic who probably even looks younger than I actually am and didn't have a PhD when I became an academic, I used to get a whole range of really interesting comments on my evaluation. So not necessarily related to the emotional work, but I would get comments on the way I dressed, and lots of comments about the fact I didn't have a PhD, how young I was, how inexperienced I might be, that certainly my male colleagues weren't. We're not getting.
No, I think when you Google professor, it's quite telling, or Google academic, it's quite telling. It's usually an older white male standing in front of a blackboard, which probably shows how outdated some of these ideas are. And it can be really challenging as a young woman to front up in front of these classroom of students, and you don't fit this cultural perception of what an academic is and even what authority itself is. Yeah, how do you deal with that?
Not too long after I became an academic, I just decided I was going to be myself. And if that meant that I would teach a class sitting down on the table at the front of the room and having a conversation with students, and yep, I would rock up in my Birkenstocks if I felt like wearing Birkenstocks, and I would unashamedly be myself. And I feel to a certain extent like I got away with that, you know, but you know, like inside me, I guess I'm still thinking maybe that wasn't what everyone would do or the norm or whatever, and that maybe I kind of snuck under the radar being myself. But that seemed to work for me. But also it doesn't work in other contexts. Like I've walked into meetings and had people say to me, this is a meeting for staff. A meeting of course coordinators, you know, degree coordinators. I am the degree coordinator, but nope, this is a meeting for staff. So, you know, it kind of cuts both ways, I guess.
Jane's just shaking her head. That's an excellent comment, Jane.
We should have been videoing this.
Yeah. Look, I think that our students are diverse, and the more diversity we can have as lecturers, the better.
Yeah.
For teaching students, and also for, you know, showing that somebody in a position of relative authority can be female, can be queer, can be a person of colour, can be whatever, is actually also represented by our students. And that can only be a good thing. So keep wearing the Birkenstocks.
And the tattoos.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It sounds like your students probably responded to the authenticity and the integrity that you're presenting to them.
I think so. I think students, I respect the fact that they're whole people, and they need to respect the fact that I'm a whole person as well. And I think it's actually really important to be a whole person in front of students and, you know, to a certain extent to talk about some of the problems that come with being a female, especially when you're teaching into a course that, you know, my classrooms were 90% female, going out into a female-dominated profession. It's really important for me to be authentically me and to be that whole person and to show them that, you know, it's not all awesome all the time. Their lives aren't awesome all the time, and we cut them slack, and I think actually they're quite prepared to cut us some slack as well if we are okay to be open about who we are.
Now, you also mentioned earlier, Kate, the F word, which I'd like to bring up about sort
you
of
said
fine.
We couldn't swear, Jess.
It's the other
the other F word,
the other F word, the longer one, where. For some of us, particularly if we come through the humanities, feminism is such an integral part of the way that we learn about the world. But there is a lot of hostility against this idea of feminism, even within the academy, where we know about it as a theory and we know about it as a way of analysing things and we know about it as a way of existing as political creatures in our environment. So how important is having a feminist position in the contemporary academy?
Essential. I think actually there's increasing hostility at the moment to feminism. I know, you know, back in the, was it in that late 80s or early 90s, Susan Faludi wrote that book Backlash and talked about the kind of reaction to the small gains that feminism had made. And I think that we're seeing, again, a kind of robust backlash against the gains that feminism has made in the academy. I know that, you know, I've had, I guess I can only talk from experience, but, you know, even in the classroom I have had students protest politely because I insist on gender equality in the readings and the resources that I use with students, and they notice it, but mostly what they, how they describe it is that there are too many women in the readings and too many people of colour, and what's with all the queer stuff? I'm like, there's one in 10 queer readings, you know, and there are 50% readings written by women, which is a kind of goal. But there is that thing about perceived bias, that, that a slight correction. So I'm trying to remember what that study is. I'm terrible at remembering names of studies. But that thing about when women speak up 30% in a board meeting or something, people who, men particularly, will say women are taking up all the room all of a sudden. Mm. So small changes can feel to people who are being affected by them like big changes, and I think sometimes that backlash is about that. There's, you know, we have a woman vice chancellor, and I've had a student and colleague say to me, well, you've won, that's enough, it's all done, why are you still complaining about feminism? So I think, I don't know what my point was. I think that it's still an essential thing. I think that there is still actually an increasing lack of understanding of what feminism is as a set of ideas and a set of practices. And I think, you know, those kind of social media movements like Not All Men and all those kind of things really demonstrate how broadly misunderstood feminism is in culture generally, and that our students and some of our peers bring that into the workplace and the classroom. Mm.
Women bring it, you know, and yeah. I think for me that's one of the biggest concerns, is that I don't want people leaving my classrooms the way I left my undergraduate classrooms, thinking, you know, I'd done literary studies and art history and I'd studied women's literature, but I kind of left and went, I'm not a feminist, you know, like I don't want that for people coming out of my classrooms. So I think it's incredibly important.
Mm. James just shaking your head again. We're just going to put up a little gif of you shaking your head.
Oh, I'm restraining myself. I think that I came through history. I'm a humanities arts person, and for me the world was always feminist. And it shocks me actually that it isn't. And at universities it isn't. I've had, you know, some academic men say things this year that I thought they wouldn't have been able to get away with for 50 years, still saying it. I mean, I was in a group where a man said, you know, well, I've always thought. He thought he was being feminist, I guess. He said, I've always thought that behind every great man is a great woman.
In front of, thank you.
Well, you know, as we're sitting there, half the group's female, and I think, you know, I'm not ever shy to say what I think, and unfortunately I do think that as women we have to still do that work of educating men and also some women, that there are issues particularly around workplace culture, particularly around what you can say and what you can't say in front of people and what will be offensive. And that's just a basic issue of politeness, to be honest. That shouldn't be about, you know, necessarily being a flag-waving, card-carrying feminist if you don't feel that necessarily. But I do think that, unfortunately, we still need to do that work. I feel a responsibility myself, even though, again, there comes the reputation of being the loudmouth feminist person who's always, you know, maybe saying things that makes people in the room uncomfortable. I do feel a responsibility to do that for the people who are coming up after me, including my, I have two daughters, who also think that the world is feminist and they just don't know yet. And I would really like to change that culture a little bit, at least to the best of my ability.
I guess the other way to see it too is that as teachers, you know, in that teaching role, I think it's, we have a really amazing opportunity to change the culture by changing the minds of young people, mostly young people, some older people who are going forward. So even though sometimes it can be really difficult and kind of, you know, you worry about where those unformed ideas are coming from or whatever. You know, I'd like to think that I'm making a difference in the world, and one of the places where, in my moments of blackness, I think, no, I am making a difference is in helping young people to gain a deeper and broader understanding of things like feminism and intersectional politics and a broader understanding of the world that isn't quite as lazy, I guess, or uninformed.
Not selfish. Selfish, yes.
Yeah, well, blinkered. I guess you can come through life. And like you say, Katie, even with the best education and the kind of best intentions, you can get a wonderful education and still somehow kind of feel uncomfortable identifying as a feminist or as someone who, is politically engaged. And, I see that a lot in young people who are like, still that kind of thing we talked about in the 80s, I'm not a feminist, but I really want equal pay and maternity leave and, la, la, la.
I'm like, a humanist. Or is that the word?
Oh, God. Humanist, equalist. They all get thrown about and, you have these students who will espouse going, I do believe in gender equality. I just don't believe in feminism. You think, well, okay, my first job here is to provide you with a dictionary definition and then have you recheck that and see how you feel at the end.
But it is a problem, when I was raised a bit like your daughters are being raised, to believe I could do anything and nothing would get in my way and whatever. And I was, as good as a man or better than a man or whatever. And so for me, those lessons that I learnt about what it means to be a feminist and what it is like for women in the world, they weren't real enough, and maybe we need to be showing real everyday stories of what it actually means to be a woman, because, reading the literature or, reading the major theoretical texts or whatever didn't help me internalise that until I got out and saw it and experienced it and, understood what the term boys club means and how that might play out and what that might look like.
Yeah, I think that's part of my academic mum's advocacy as well, is that for a lot of women coming up, they don't hit any of that gender stereotyping or overt or implicit sexism until they have children.
Yeah.
Because, women are still the ones giving birth, breastfeeding, not having enough sleep. That initial period of caregiving is quite intense, and before you have children you don't realise that. You can't really explain it to other people. And so even if you have, a partnership of equality with your male partner or female partner, there's still a lot of, physical stuff that's going on. I think women, a lot of women do have great ideas about, of course, we're equal, of course. And then you have a child and there's not only the issues of you coping with that new event in your life and your new responsibilities, but all of a sudden you're really aware that other people are viewing you differently. Mm-hmm. And actually that may be the way that they've been viewing you since you were born as a woman, but you weren't aware of that. And so it's a very easy thing. I mean, I think this idea of bagging women with children, even from the perspective of other women making excuses, I think that that's actually quite sexist. Mm. And it's because you're not putting yourself in the place of the other person, and none of us can actually do that. Okay, that's what we're trying to teach our students. Well, I am as a history teacher. That, owning your privilege. For a lot of women who have had maybe a charmed existence in Australia and through university life and this theory of equality, of course it's not equality in practice, and I know that because I'm older and I've had more experience. But unfortunately, that will hit every woman at some stage, whether they end up having children or not, I think, that you do become increasingly aware that we don't have that equality yet. And for me, obviously it's a personal responsibility and it's a personal issue having children. But if it's not children, I think it will be something else.
Yeah.
Okay, so for example, sitting in that group with the men saying things like, behind every great man is a woman. I mean, who would even think that, never mind say it, in front of about 10 leading early career researchers, you know, who've been handpicked as leaders in their field, and saying that out loud, that affects every woman, whether you're, you know, that's a cultural thing.
Mm. And I think in that situation also the fact that you said something but those that you're with didn't shows a lot about how we've internalized a lot of these problems and thinking, well, do I, even though I hold these feminist positions, do I have a voice in this environment, or am I still going to hold myself back because I fear the professional repercussions as being, you know, the mouthy broad who's constantly raising these issues?
I think that was possibly the saddest thing about that experience, because that was there were quite a few comments made that were really offensive to me. I'd never actually heard people say things like that out loud before in a university environment. You know, maybe down the local pub, but not, you know, not in a professional setting amongst equals. And I talked to the women. I thought, oh, my God, maybe I'm just overreacting. It has been known to happen. And they said, no, we hear that sort of thing all the time. I just ignore it. Which is a way to handle it, because I guess you have to live your life and you just do the best you can and not waste any attention on that. But, you know, I think also that we do have a responsibility to shut that down as soon as it occurs, for the sake not only of ourselves but for everybody else, all the other women who – and there are women who won't say anything because they might also have, you know, other issues. They might be you know, not white, not straight, not whatever. That, so there's two things or three things. And so they feel that otherwise they'd be constantly battling. So perhaps, you know, with my privilege, I can come out and just fight for this one issue that affects me and affects lots of other people. That makes sense?
Make perfect sense to me, Jane.
Makes perfect sense, but also the other thing that I'm sitting here thinking is this is more emotional labour. Like this is hard work, and it's work we need to do, but it is added to all that other.
Yeah, one of my friends is a person of colour who's deeply involved, kind of, I don't know, social activism around women, representation of women, and particularly women of colour in games, which is a kind of odd, you know, we need diverse game stuff. And she talks about that a lot, that the thing is about that stuff is the labour of educating people about gender and race and ability and sexual diversity and all of those sorts of things always falls to the people who are the most oppressed and don't have a good voice and get punished for speaking out and punished for being angry in inverted commas. So I think you're right. There is that sense that, you know, it is a great responsibility, and if we have a little bit of privilege, and we do because we're sitting in this university setting with, you know, a healthy paycheck every week and relatively secure work, you know, all these positive things that we've gained and that feminism has gained for us. But at the same time, you know, there are very kind of real but sometimes hard to quantify costs of being the angry feminist or the out queer person or the mother with small children or the, you know, Indigenous person in the workplace, that you get lumped with all of that extra work and that you get punished for insisting that there's a difference in the way that you're being treated or your students are being treated or, I mean, I've felt that cost over time. And sometimes the hardest thing is when it's harder to quantify and pinpoint, you know, when you're in a meeting and someone says something really overt and awful, you're like, well, I'm angry about that. But when you've been working somewhere for 3 years and you're kind of like, well, it's just not, things are not going. And why are all those boys and why are all the women washing the tea towels? I don't really you know, and you sort of, it's just happened and you're not really sure why. You know, those things I think are harder to fight and harder to get angry about. And anyway, gone off on a tangent. I'll just
drop my
tea towel tangent.
But I think what you're sort of touching upon there as well, Nikki, is the idea of the hashtag all male panel, where we have an all female panel here, which I think is appropriate for Blue Stocking Week. But the way in which systems of authority and cultures of authority are still perpetuated through our academic cultures about these ideas of expertise, where if we're going to talk about an issue, we get a lineup of men and usually white men as well, and usually straight white men. So is this something that is, still middle class? So there are, you know, there are class issues, there are race issues, there are issues around sexuality as well. What do we do about the all-male panel? Do you think that we're doing enough to try and diversify academic leadership?
I think you need to call it out. We had something, we had exactly that issue at the Australian Historical Association, our annual meeting, conference this year. The last panel on the future of history, which, you know, sounds quite important and should possibly be progressive, was, you know, it was an all-male panel. It was an all-white, middle-class, possibly straight, you know, it was very, very white bread. Twitter immediately, our conference has a Twitter hashtag and there's a very active Twitter following. And so people actually who weren't even there started this, this backlash against this, that, you know, yes, they may have been appropriate people to talk about what you wanted to ask at that particular point, but there could have been more thought put into this, and actually the effect that has on female historians, on, you know, on lots of diverse historians doing diverse history and doing fantastic things, when you're only looking at these, you know, very specific sort of subjects and the very stereotypical, you know, white male professor talking head at the top of the panel. And so there was a backlash. And it went all the way to the top and there were apologies. And I don't think it'll happen again. So, again, that's emotional work that somebody, you know, has to call this out. But if there are enough of us doing it, then I think if you ever do, you know, think that, oh, that doesn't seem right, say something.
And be the advocate on the organising committees as well. I think I'm on an organising committee at the moment where pretty much the whole committee arrived at the same sort of idea at the same time around we need to achieve some kind of balance in programming and particularly around keynotes and panel sessions. But I've been on a lot of conference committees and that's the first time I've seen it. You know, I've seen these panels stacked with men even in a profession that is dominated by women, you know, talking about issues that, you know, we need diversity at the table, you know, and it is straight white men. And we need all kinds of diversity, not just gender diversity at the table.
And what do you do in situations where the people who are on the panel, who are on the table, are not only appropriate, but they're allied to that cause, that they acknowledge that there should be diversity, but they're sitting there still having this place of privilege and this place of power? Is how do we deal with that situation?
I think good allies often step back voluntarily and offer the place. So I think, I think that sometimes allies can become, you know, and there's some criticism of this in the American kind of context, that allies can take up a lot of space. So, you know, white people speaking for Indigenous issues in Australia is certainly, you know, in the academy in particular, is certainly kind of an issue. So I think if you are an ally and you're asked to speak on behalf of someone, you know, a group that you don't represent, then maybe you can be proactive in saying, hey, couldn't you find a queer person or a person of colour, or I'd be happy to step in if you can't find that person. But don't you think maybe you could try a little harder?
Yeah, and of course that is also down to us as particularly us in the room here as, you know, white female academics, that we also have to be conscious of that, that we do have a place of relative privilege in our society. And that should be something that as thoughtful people we're constantly thinking about, you know, is there someone that we can raise up who doesn't have that voice usually?
But I guess one of the problems here is also that we're functioning in the age of the neoliberal university, where we're often looking after ourselves and our own careers, and there's a competitiveness rather than a collegiality that's fostered, so that this idea of raising people up can, you know, sound really great and be something that we kind of want to do. But when we're thinking, in a self-interested manner about our careers, we think, oh, but if I do that, I'm going to lose this opportunity. How do we combat that kind of sentiment within ourselves but also within our communities?
I think that there is a lot of competitiveness, particularly between ECRs, going for jobs and that sort of thing. In my experience, I've had some fantastic female mentors and fantastic female colleagues, and also now more junior people. And I think competitiveness actually doesn't get anybody anywhere. That opportunities in academia tend to come from networking. Mm. And actually, the more friends that you have, the better, really. And, you know, if there's someone who's particularly a competitor, you're in exactly the same area, be close to that person. You know, you can actually then become collaborators. You can push each other forward. And I think I made that conscious decision as a feminist decision quite early on, not to be that person and to be constantly pushing forward female, particularly when I'm in a position of power. So if I'm organising conferences or panels or seminars or reviewing a book asking around for jobs, if there's jobs available, then I would prefer to hire a junior female academic solely because it needs to be done. And that's my responsibility as a good academic citizen and a feminist, I think.
I think I feel the same way. Raising other people up and supporting other people is beneficial for them. It's beneficial for the academy. It's beneficial for you in the longer term. I would rather have a stronger cohort of people working in my discipline and my space. That's going to serve us better than me taking up all their time. I think we have strength in numbers, and that's really important. And I've had really good role modelling around that as well. It is really important. I think for me, it's not just about raising up women. It's about finding the right person for the right opportunity and helping to support people to flourish. But there definitely is that element there. And even things with mentoring students and supporting students in their careers as well, I think, you know, these are really important parts of what we do.
So how important has mentoring been overall in your careers? Have you all had positive either female or male mentors?
Look, I've had some not so positive female mentors, but I guess that's also coming from their perceived lack of power and their, not wanting necessarily to encourage younger females to enter academia. But on the other hand, I've had some very strong female mentors who I'm working at the moment in an all-female group on an ARC project and, you know, which is a fruitful where all the best people for the job as well, yeah. Of course. But I think, that's to me, even just having one person that you can look at and say, and for me particularly someone who has children, who's had to move interstate to find a job, who struggles, you know, with the daily, who's taking out the garbage and who's unpacking the dishwasher and picking the kids up, that sort of thing, to have female colleagues who are going through exactly the same thing has been enormously helpful in my very dark times when I think I can't do it. I think, well, you know what, they do it. And I think for everybody that's helpful to have somebody who's like them achieving in a similar position. And so, of course, then you need to go to show that downwards as well to people who are coming up through the ranks.
I don't think I've necessarily had that, people with similar situations to me around me. I have had a really great mentor who has a different life to me, doesn't have children, has a different career focus, but has equally supported, how I want to operate and what I want to be as an academic. But I can't say that I can pinpoint someone who works in the way that I want to work and has the same set of kind of life circumstances as me, who necessarily contributes the same way I want to contribute. And so I think that's been a challenge for me as well. And I think part of it is that my circumstances are unusual. It's stuff around atypical families and how we engage, but there aren't, I guess, there are great women out there. I think we're all just so, I'm not allowed to swear, I think we're all so incredibly busy that sometimes those formal mentoring arrangements don't get up or don't fly. But, you know, I have been extremely fortunate to have someone who can see my perspective and has empathy and gets my circumstances. And it's really, really important.
I find the formal ones to be like bad dates.
Yes.
They've never worked for me. It's more that weird thing when you reflect on it and go, oh, that person is my mentor. Oh, okay. Rather than, you know, let's have a coffee with this person and
it has to be organic.
Yeah.
It has to be coming from a place of friendship as well, I think.
Yes.
So my most important mentor is not a mother and has, you know, very limited understanding really of the restrictions around that. But just giving, you know, the belief that you can do it and support. And I should say that I've had fantastic male mentors as well who have been, you know, coming up through academia, getting a PhD and finding a job, particularly in the capital cities in Australia today and particularly in my field, is very, very difficult. It's very, very competitive. And so any form of support from anybody, just believing that in your particular circumstances, you can do it.
Yeah.
And, I think that's really very important.
I think that context thing is incredibly important too, the way that the academic workforce is structured right now. I mean, I was on 12-month contracts for 6 years in my last job. And, you know, I think there are some gender issues around recruitment of early career academics. Mm. And there's also a whole lot of other issues about casualisation of the workforce and, you know, underemployment and all of these other issues. And so mentoring for me was critical in terms of getting myself into a permanent position. But I also felt like when I did get there, I should be very grateful that I was there. I think part of that, me internalizing that need to be grateful, is a gendered thing as well.
But expressing that gratitude is giving back.
Yeah. I think, you know, I do feel I'm very grateful for the mentoring that went along with it. But I guess for me, I kind of, it's hard when you see other people underemployed and other people who are really struggling to get academic appointments. I mean, the situation is not particularly good. My field is very similar. There just aren't any jobs and, you know, that's quite tough.
Mm. I think you're absolutely right, Katie. I think that the casualisation of academic work is really having a much more marked impact on women.
Yeah.
And that, you know, appointments are still largely, you know, except in particular disciplines, you know, full-time appointments are going much more disproportionately to men, and women are, you know, huge part of the sessional ranks. And it's kind of funny for me as someone who employs sessional staff that I at the moment employ this semester only women, which is kind of incidental, but, you know, some part of the problem and part of this, so they're getting work and mentoring, and I'm really conscious of the way that I employ them and the way that I relate to them and making them, I don't know, keep records and get, you know, all these kinds of things. But at the same time, there's not a full-time position I can offer them. So it's, you know, not about exploiting them in that space, because I think sessional staff are largely exploited by the university sector.
There are ways of, you know, acknowledging that reality of how the labour market works in the university sector, but still trying to be as ethical as you possibly can within that system, and when that opportunity strikes, to, you know, push that wonderful young career, early career researcher forward and say, hey, go for this.
Yeah. But it's the whole way along. It's about trying to get their contracts done as early as possible, not at the last minute, to support them with as much teaching material as you can, to make sure they're getting paid for the labour they're doing, to tell them to stop working when they've gone past their contract hours, and not just to do it anyway in the hope that one day in the future they'll be loved back by the sector, you know. That just doesn't happen. So I think, like, all of that stuff, you know, keeping records, keeping their student evaluations and their impromptu kind of feedback, so kind of seeing it as a holistic opportunity to mentor someone who's you know, probably looking for a job, you know, and thinking about, don't just do the same session of work all the time, you know, look at what your CV is going to look like, think about getting more kind of moderation position. Anyway.
No, absolutely. And I think things that we can do as academics are helpful. We can share our CVs, or we can look over people's CVs. We can share our promotion documents and or look over those sorts of things, grant applications, all sorts of things. And women do that. Women do that. And I think that's great. I really do. And I think we should keep doing that. Yeah. Because, you know, we don't have the confidence necessarily of a mediocre white man. A lot of us are quite talented, and we don't necessarily believe in that. And unfortunately, we do have to compete with people who don't have the same gender stereotypes, the same caregiving responsibilities, the same whatever. And so you have to put your best foot forward. So why don't we all help each other to do that?
Yeah, it's really important. I just came from having coffee with a friend who's doing a project and felt like she was floundering, and she kind of showed me what she's done. And I was like, this is great. This is exactly what you need to have done. And she was like, okay. And sometimes we just need those
positive
touch points.
Information.
Yeah, and it is part of that emotional work. I don't know. I think that emotional work is really important. I think we do a lot more of it than men, but I also think it's so critical that we do it.
Does that emotional labour sometimes result in that greater satisfaction?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing more satisfying than seeing someone that particular person is someone that I've known for a long time, and I've mentored in other situations, and she kind of mentors me in situations, and seeing someone else fly, there's nothing else more satisfying, than that.
I think one of the other ideas that comes out of this as well, there's often challenges to our confidence and the idea that we all suffer from a form of imposter syndrome, and it's particularly prevalent for women within academia. How do we deal with this?
Build each other up at every opportunity.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with it within yourself, though?
Therapy?
Medication?
No.
Talk about it.
Yeah, talking about it's a great strategy. That's such a great question, Jess. And I think it's, it is something that impacts on women in the academy much more than other people. But I also think I think it's a class issue too.
Yeah.
And I know as someone who didn't go to a private school or go to high school or any of those things, those things also impact on my sense of an imposter. Being an imposter. So I think sharing the problem, sharing your anxiety, it's great. I often share my anxiety with my students about my writing career, which is kind of affirming, and, we talk about that kind of feeling of never being good enough and, all those sorts of things. So I think sharing those stories is important, and building each other up is really important. Affirming each other and taking those opportunities to say to other people around you, but women in particular around you, hey, you're doing a great job. I really like that thing you did, whatever it was.
Yeah. Social media has been very, very important. And I think a lot of young academics, early career academics and PhD students feel very isolated. And I think class is such an issue that we haven't really discussed, but affects men and women almost equally, but I think it does affect women more because gender disparity within working class communities is usually higher. So there's that to cope with as well. I use Facebook and Twitter, really, social media, as community groups for myself. That's my sort of therapy and way of giving back. So any sort of issue, and I've found lots of people from working class backgrounds, because I am as well, and we build each other up as well via social media, women via social media, underemployed ACRs, and also the issues that you might have within academia. We don't always, when we're at work, we're busy, we're rushing from one lecture to another, or we might not have time to stop for coffee or, with our colleagues on the floor, but there's always someone on the other end of the computer or your smartphone, who will listen to your sorry tale and give you some support, and you can do that for other people as well. I think that's something actually that I'm very grateful to be living in this decade that I can do that. Yeah.
Yes, as a social media researcher.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that celebration and doing it for other people, like helping people to normalise, and social media can be a really powerful tool in helping other people to normalise their experience of anything. My research, I've done research around normalising mothering. But like taking time to celebrate the people around us who've done great stuff and to, you know, highlight people for on social media, even to say, I just read this really great, like, how many times do you read an article and then I'll put it aside and I'll use it in a paper later on, but it, you know, there's some great insight in there. It takes 2 seconds to tweet and link to this article that you've read, or to say something positive about another person. And I think that's just part of being a good human being. But we're so busy, we don't necessarily do those things. But and this is something that I really learned from, you know, my kind of key mentor, is celebrating other people and their successes. You know, particularly people who are working for you or may not have the same kind of position of power or authority that you have, like really highlighting other people's wins, that helps them to kind of to normalize their experience and to think it's, you know, they aren't an imposter, you know, even if it's just for that window of time when they're thinking about that that celebration. But those are the things that help us to understand ourselves as non-imposters, as a real people.
And I guess the other part of that is kind of when you're celebrating other people's successes is being really specific about the thing that they've done that means that they've earned it, not that it's just some kind of accolade for being, you know, you're the woman of the week or you're the...
Not some random LinkedIn endorsement.
Yeah, so kind of meaningful positive feedback, I think, is often, you know, they say that in child-rearing, not that I've been reading child-rearing literature lately, but, you know, that empty affirmation is nowhere near as useful in the long term as kind of affirmation that's actually about behaviour rather than just you're a cute kid.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't want to do that kind of thing with your colleagues, is saying you're great in this kind of ambit way that's not meaningful, but in concrete and specific ways about things they've actually done that are meaningful achievements, or that they could put in their promotion application, or I'm writing you this thing. You know, that's really, that's kind of concrete, I think, rather than just, does that make sense?
Kind of it does. And it kind of ties into some advice that my mentor once gave me about having a folder and in my inbox called promotion, where I file those things, forward myself a tweet that somebody said, or, you know, file those emails, those comments from students. Those folders shouldn't just be about promotion. They should be like anti-imposter syndrome folders as well. You know, like you go to them and go, if you're having a really crap day, you can go to that folder and get that kind of affirmation. That's not something I do, but it's definitely something I've recommended other people do.
My folder's called You Are Awesome.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Awesome. As I said, the only other strategy that I can think of off the top of my head is a little less visible, is that when I'm working as a peer reviewer for journals and things like that, that we work in such academia can be such a culture of criticism and kind of negative feedback. Sharing work with your peers or doing peer reviewing or looking at enriched staff or managing staff, to not just be kind of managing failure all the time, or, you know, managing upwards, but also kind of using those opportunities to provide positive feedback about things that they're doing well.
Yeah.
Something I started doing years ago, not to combat imposter syndrome, but just to help myself feel like I was actually achieving anything when it felt like I was treading water, is I would write a done list at the end of the year, and it was something that I'd either blog or I'd write in kind of blog post format and kind of remind myself of what I actually got done that year. And it was just a strategy to kind of keep myself centered, because I remember I left one job about a decade ago and felt like I'd had my head up against a brick wall the whole time and just hadn't achieved anything. It's a powerful way to kind of unstick yourself when you feel like you're not getting anywhere. But I think it's also possibly a good strategy to combat imposter syndrome, is really take some time to reflect on what you've actually achieved, and not just at work, you know, at home as well.
I did the dishes. Sometimes that can be all you need, is just knowing that you are capable of achieving something.
Yeah.
And it will get you out of bed and help you to mark that essay or to write that article or do whatever it is that you need to get done. Now, as a final question, as we draw it to a close, I'd like to ask you, what advice would you give to young women, but also to young men, to young queer students, to young students of colour entering into the academic sector today?
I really like the saying that we're all smart, be kind. And that's something that has had a big following on Twitter as well amongst the academics I follow, academic kindness, this idea. And I think that works for everybody, you know. Of course, it helps enormously yourself, you know, when academics are kind, particularly, I mean, that issue of peer review can be quite horrendous for a young academic. And there are, you know, academics who are known for being nasty.
Reviewer number two.
Sorry?
Reviewer number two.
Being nasty and being proud of it too is what I find upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, in history we know who they are and they do it to everybody. And young women seem to be, a huge target. So I think that's something we like as academics. It's very, it is competitive and we do like to put our ego out there sometimes. You know, we know this and you need to publish this because I've found this out and I write this beautifully and whatever else. And I really just love that saying, we're all smart. We're all here because we know how to work hard. We know how to think about things academically according to our particular discipline. We've all done what it takes to get here. We're all smart. You don't need to prove that after a certain stage, you know. And being kind really is the difference between living a fulfilling life in academia, I think, and just being an ego-driven business along that sort of normative male white professor stereotype, which is probably, you know, just a stereotype. I'm sure they've always been kind academics. But for me, really, that is all of my advice distilled into one phrase.
Yeah, I guess I'd add to that, be generous and, you know, support the people around you because they're probably having as difficult a time as you are. And related to that, I think getting a tribe that you building a tribe that supports you, that you can identify with, that might be experiencing similar issues, you know, having a tribe is so important. And they don't have to be local. They can be a social media-based tribe or whatever. You know, I took in the context of what I do with teaching, we talk about personal learning networks and helping students to build those. And I guess it's a bit like having that personal learning network, but it's also a bit of a personal element thrown into the mix as well. Like, you know, build a tribe and make sure it's a tribe that you don't just talk about the issues with being in your office and being an academic, but talk about you as a whole person, because I think, you know, that's really incredibly important. And I would say my tribe has been, you know, is a huge reason that I have an academic career at all and didn't give up, because I tried, you know, in my second year of being an academic, I did think, oh, this is just too hard. I'm never, you know, I started an academic position because I thought this would be an easier way to get a PhD done than trying to do it while I was in practice. Well, that was just the most ridiculous idea ever. And I did try to call it quits. And I think, you know, having that tribe there was really important to me in terms of sticking with it and, you know, of sticking with a PhD. I had such a great cheer squad doing my PhD, and, you know, I graduated at the same time as some of my students graduated from their masters, and, you know, I had students on the stage cheering for me. Like, they were part of the cheer squad as well. So I think it's really important to get that network sorted.
Oh, I don't know if I have anything else to add. I guess I left the academy for a while. I took a kind of big gap, not for children or anything else, just for personal reasons. And when I re-entered it, I really made a vow to myself that I wouldn't give my soul to the academy, because the thing that I'd learned was that it wouldn't love me back. So that, you know, I mean, I guess that sounds a bit cynical, because I think being kind and being generous, I think those are absolutely really important things. But I think also not thinking that this is your life, you know, it's a job. It's a really rewarding, enriching, wonderful job, and feel really honoured to have it. But at the same time, it's not my life. It's not my children. It's not my partner. It's not my home. I'm not, you know, I think in some ways preserving and protecting the part of my life and myself that doesn't belong to the academy is really important to me, and nurturing that. Those relationships in that space that aren't just about the job.
So being kind to yourself.
Yeah, I think so. And generous with yourself.
Yeah. It is hard because, you know, it's easy to let work bleed all over all of
to spend your whole weekend doing research papers and marking and answering email. And, you know, I mean, that's the most kind of pragmatic, obvious face of that stuff. But thinking that that's the job too, that your whole life is actually the job.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to the three of you for your wonderful words of insight that hopefully will be helping future generations of academic as they come into this fraught environment, but also this incredibly rewarding and enriching career. So thank you for your generosity and your kindness in joining me here today.
Thank you, Jess.